And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and we're delighted to have Mark Greaney back on the program today. Mark is one of the most exciting writers of international thrillers on the scene today. He co-wrote several Jack Ryan novels with Tom Clancy and even continued the series for several years after Mr. Clancy's passing. Mark's own series, starring burned CIA agent Court Gentry, now known as the Gray Man, has recently welcomed its seventh volume, Agent in Place, which has Gentry dealing with the ramifications of the Syrian Civil War. Mark, when we spoke about your last Court Gentry book, Gunmetal Gray, you said the next book was going to be called Weaponized, unless someone else changed it. So who changed it to Agent in Place and why?
Someone else changed it. It was very prophetic of me. I've been at this job for a while now, so I saw that coming. I didn't see it coming. It was basically a dual decision. An original plot point in the story involved sarin gas in Syria and the hero trying to stop a sarin gas attack. And so Weaponized kind of fit into that. I like it when titles actually have relevance to the novel. A lot of times they don't. Just for me, I like it if there's some place in the novel that it refers back to the title in some way. I was thinking sort of on my own without saying anything about it that Weaponized didn't really make sense for the title, but that's what we've been calling it for 6 months at that point, or I don't know, 3 months, where I decided that plot became a subplot, which kind of got edited on the cutting room floor. And about the same time, the publisher came back and they said, with Gunmetal Gray, you have these multiple words on the title, and it looks good, you know, just physically on the cover. And so they just said the cover just physically looks good on Gunmetal Gray, and Weaponized going across the art just doesn't look as good. It's like, could you come up with a shorter, choppier name? And so in the story, the hero, Court Gentry, is called the agent in place for this organization in Syria. And so that's why it became the title.
I can guess with Weaponized, with it being such a long word, that if you wanted it to be tall,
yeah,
it had to be very narrow letters.
Exactly. And that's what they were explaining to me. You know, the art isn't my bag or whatever, but I've always loved the covers that they've done. And so that was feedback that a lot easier pill to swallow, because I was already thinking that the title wasn't really germane to the story.
Also, with it being three words, you know, if you were doing an online trailer for it, you could have three stamping sounds and agent in place.
That's great.
And things come in threes,
yeah,
are more exciting for
That's
humans,
right.
It seems.
Yeah, we've got to get you on the marketing team.
Now, the book starts off with a prologue, and it's in media re for the action of the book. Court Gentry is being held by ISIS in Syria, and he's getting ready to be executed. I have to say, you put him in a pretty good pickle there at the very beginning of the book.
Yeah, I wanted readers to kind of have it in the back of their head as the story goes on. It's like, A, how does he get into this situation that you read about in the prologue? And obviously, B, how does he get out of this situation? Or hopefully he gets out of this situation. I came up with that idea really early of opening the book that way and then figuring out how we got there. And so in chapter one, he's telling people that there's no way you're going to get him into Syria. The reader already knows that he's in Syria. I just thought that would be kind of fascinating to the readers. It's real important to me that I do sort of different things in each book and not cover the same ground. And this was something I hadn't done before, to give that in media re sense of, okay, we know something that goes on later in the story. Let's back up and figure out how we got there.
In general, when you're writing an action scene, do you have a solution in mind and you kind of have to build a situation that leads up to it? Or do you just throw him into a situation and you have to think his way out of it?
It's both ways. I know that I've definitely written characters into corners I couldn't figure out how to get them out of in action scenes before. Sometimes I think of like some big kinetic escape from something or whatever, and then I'll create the action in front of that. And other times I just, you know, think, all right, we're going to have an action scene. This needs to happen in the story. You know, this is how the story will be propelled forward by the action scene. And I just work through one point at a time and work the situation through. I always want to make the story, I always want to sort of push the envelope, but at the same time kind of like make it, if not totally believable, at least possible. The things that happen, the laws of physics aren't, you know, affected, but the guy's got a really good jump, you know, that sort of thing. It's not a Marvel comic story. It's an action story. And I like the high stakes and the consequences of the fact that, gosh, you can fall and, you know, off this building and all these sorts of things.
Well, you mentioned there was a subplot with sarin gas that didn't make it into the final book. How often do you find yourself having these subplots or big chunks of the book that have to go away?
I always write an outline to give to my editor before I start, and it's usually 10 pages. Sometimes it's 20 pages. I think this one was probably about 10 pages. And it has all my ideas for what I want to do for the story. And it's told as a story. So it's like he goes here, he does this, he does this. I write that before I've done the research on the novel, because I do the research and the writing concurrently mostly. And so a lot of my outline, I look at it, it's kind of this Flash Gordon, you know, just pie in the sky. Well, it'd be really cool. And then he, you know, infiltrates ISIS or something like that. And then as you get into the nitty gritty of doing it, you're like, you know, could I sell this to the reader? Does this make sense? Or is there a better way? So things change a lot from that. And I don't even look at the outline again after the editor and I agree on it. I just have it enough of it in my head and I start going along. And so sometimes subplots totally fall by the wayside. Sometimes I add characters or I add subplots because I think the reader might be interested in what the French police are doing now. So I create French police characters and have them in the novel, you know, that sort of thing.
You often write and research simultaneously. Tell us about your fun trip to Syria then.
I didn't go to Syria. Looked into it. You can go in as a journalist and you're, you know, tied with the government. And I didn't think it'd be that useful and probably not that safe. I went to France. So I did the easy, I did the low-hanging fruit research from this novel because it takes place in Paris and it takes place in Damascus mostly. Of those two places, I went to the Paris location, funny enough. You know, I've been to the Middle East before, so I definitely used that. I did a ton of research on Syria. I used to, for some strange reason, back in the 80s, I was really fascinated with the Lebanese Civil War. And I spent a ton of time reading books about that. A lot of things that are going on in Syria, which is right next door to Lebanon, kind of harken back to that for me, like, you know, are similar to me in different ways. So that research for the what's happening in Syria was fascinating. I did a ton of it.
There's a big fashion show sequence in the book. Did you go to a fashion show?
I didn't. I knew people would ask me that, and I probably knew you would ask me that. I did not go to Fashion Week. My wife went with me to Paris, and we were there in January, so it was not, you know, the prime time to be there, but it was, you know, it was really nice. Paris is really nice any time of the year. Fashion Week happens over multiple weeks throughout the year, but it was going on while I was there. And I did look at locations. I kind of went outside the location that is in the book where, you know, other things happened. You know, I definitely like scouted them out and walked inside and that sort of thing. But I didn't really become an aficionado of the fashion world for the book. The gray man gets in and out of that situation pretty quickly.
But your wife has a background like jewelry design, right?
Yeah, she does.
And yeah. So did she was actually able to contribute to the...
She always does. I always ask her questions about clothes or style or shoes or just anything like that, and she'll know it. She wanted to go to Fashion Week. We could never really make it happen and get your way in. I had to push by the Kardashians to get in there, and I didn't do it.
Now, as the book proper opens up, the gray man is meeting a Syrian doctor in a Parisian cemetery. What are they discussing?
Yeah, it's a couple, Tarek and Rima Halabi. And they are civilian doctors who are Syrian expatriates. They're living in Paris, and they have started an aid organization to help the Syrian population involved in the civil war. And they just basically, bullets and Band-Aids and blankets had been their job, but they have come across some information through some nefarious characters that the mistress of the president of Syria is a model, is a Spanish model. No one knows that she's the mistress to the Syrian president, and she is in Paris for Fashion Week. And they have a plan to kidnap her, to use her to try and help end the war. They think she has some information that would make life difficult for Ahmed Azam, who is sort of the stand-in for Bashar Assad, the current president of Syria. Their idea is to use the gray man, the hero, to kidnap this girl there in Paris, make it out like it's a pretty easy job, but of course it's not.
So many of the best and the brightest of the Syrian resistance have already been killed at this point.
Yeah.
They're reaching pretty far onto the bench to pull up the Halabis.
Yeah, exactly. So for the Halabis to become, and the hero makes this point, you know, it's like for you guys to become the resistance leaders, you know, just very, you know, middle-aged, peaceful cardiac surgeons. You know, all the research I was doing on Syria was, that's what you learn. You learn that, you know, the best and the brightest of the revolutionaries in Syria have already been killed because of just the wholesale slaughter that's gone on down there. And I remember I'd read about World War II, and you sort of think of the Nazis as this one thing with the Nazis that, you know, people were fighting after the, you know, the Battle of the Bulge and after whatever was a whole different group of people than they were, you know, invaded Poland in 1939 or were around, you know, during the Battle of Britain or something like that. as you said, going deeper and deeper into the bench to get these people to where, you know, by the end of the war in Berlin, it was, you know, it was
16
kids.
And 17.
Yeah. It was kids and old men or whatever who'd been conscripted. And so that had always fascinated me, that concept of understanding that. And I wanted that to come out in this story.
It's not only for the resistance side, because Ahmed Azam, who's the stand-in for Bashar al-Assad, mm-hmm. and like Bashar, was not supposed to be in power.
Right.
He was the second son.
Exactly. He was the second son, and the heir apparent to Hafez al-Assad, the parent, died in a car crash in Damascus. And Hafez al-Assad was a dentist, I think, in London.
Bashar.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Bashar al-Assad was
ophthalmologist, I think.
Ophthalmologist. Thank you. I didn't sound right somehow. Ophthalmologist living in London, you know, was not really planning on being involved in the regime, and then he was brought back in. First couple of years, everybody thought, you know, he had a very cosmopolitan wife, and they thought this was going to mean great things because Hafez al-Assad, his father, was a, you know, a brutal dictator, and they thought Bashar would be more easygoing, and unfortunately, it's been anything but.
So how closely is Ahmed Azam based on Bashar al-Assad?
Very closely in a lot of the historical details. It talks about in the book about his brother dying, and that's how he's pulled in. It talks about the First Lady and how they met. I did a lot of sort of artistic license with the First Lady in this book, Asma Assad, thank you, and Shakira Azam are the same person. And in the book, her name is Shakira Azam. I made her a little bit older. I made her a lot more. It is true that Assad, the president, is an Alawite, an Alawi, which is a Sunni sect of Islam, and his wife is... Shia sect of Islam, and his wife is a Sunni. You know, and I've read a lot of things about how, you know, the real life First Lady has, you know, helped her husband's relationship with the Sunnis. I extrapolated on that. I wanted to make the First Lady of Syria this major power player in the country, and I don't know that that's true at all in the real world, but it worked for the story. I wanted her to know about this mistress. I wanted her to have her own, you know, machinations, and she has her own intelligence force, you know, trying to silence this woman because she knows it will be bad for her. So I did take artistic license more with her than with her husband.
I was looking up the Alawi sect online, and it said, I can't remember the name, it's an Arabic name, but it's not quite a heresy or heretical movement, but it literally means exaggerators.
Ah.
And the Alawis are considered to be exaggerators because they think of certain people in the past of Islamic history to mm-hmm. have divine.
Yeah, to be divine, whereas only, you know, the one in the Shia sect is. And it's interesting because they are aligned so closely with Iran right now, because for Iran, you know, they're Shia enough. And Iran has their own interests in Syria, so they're propping up the Alawi regime, although they are definitely, it's not the same religion, you know, as far as they're concerned. It's just a sect.
Now, are all Baathists aligned with Alawism, or?
No. There's Baathists all over, Sunnis, there's Baathists all over the Middle East. You know, when you do a ton of research into this, you think, all right, does this go into my action thriller or not? Am I getting too deep in the weeds? But a lot of it was just really fascinating. You're like, well, here's a story. You know, and part of it was that it's not so much a religious war. It's, you know, it's a political war because there's Christians that support the Assad regime in the book, Azam. There's Sunnis and different groups. There's criminal organizations in Syria who are fielding soldiers because they're trying to keep the regime propped up. So it's all about the power of the leader in the palace.
Well, and I thought that was fascinating because Court Gentry, who's supposed to be this international man and know about these conflicts around the world, even he didn't know kind of the depths and the particulars of the alliances that go into making up the bigger groups at play in Syria.
Yeah, well, part of that obviously is an info dump for the readers because you want to explain it to the readers in an interesting way. The hero who's there on the ground has to figure it out really, really quickly. And it is complicated. It is really complicated because the people hear about the Free Syrian Army as fighting against the SAA, the Syrian Arab Army, the government army. But in the real world, the Free Syrian Army is dozens of different groups of people. And there's even some jihadists in there. And then you have the jihadists fighting against the evil regime. So you have the evil jihadists fighting against the evil regime. And I wanted to put the gray man in there. And on the regime side, you have all these other different militant groups and sects. It's not all one thing. I didn't want to turn the book into a novel about political science, but I wanted to give a couple of paragraphs to be like, all right, this is the morass that the gray man has just, fallen smack dab in the middle of and has to negotiate his way through.
It kind of reminded me of those high school movies of the 80s where a new kid comes to school and someone has to explain the different cliques.
Yeah. It is. It's like that. It's just in a Civil War setting.
Was this the most politically complex story you've had to research for the Gray Man series?
Yeah, I'm sure it was. Just because, I've written about Russia and I've written about Chinese cyber attacks or whatever. But this is something that's going on right now. I started writing this book a year ago, finished it last June. At the time, I was very worried that, the political winds would have shifted so much that this book would, there not be as relevant story-wise. Unfortunately, honestly, if anything, there's more in the news about Syria and horrible things that are going on in there with some of the different players. So it was complicated to research. I wanted to make it not complicated in the story, as I said before. But yeah, I spent a lot of time thinking, this could be a whole different chessboard, by the time the book comes out, but it hasn't.
And the Halabis want to kidnap Bianca Medina, Azam's mistress, not only because of that pressure she could put on him, but she actually has information that they want to be able to exploit.
Yes. Russia and Iran are both vying for Syria's
kind of be
fealty.
Patron states.
Yeah, exactly. They both want to be patron states for different reasons. And I thought if Bianca Medina, this mistress, had some information that would hurt the relationship between Iran and Russia and the relationship between Iran and Azam and Russia and Azam, it could be really interesting. So that's how that works.
And Cord is involved in this as a freelancer. He's not on a CIA assignment on this trip.
That's right. Yeah, the background of my hero, the Gray Man, is he's a former CIA officer who was then blacklisted by the CIA. Now he is back as sort of a contract agent that certain members of the CIA can call on. Highly illegal in the real world, but who knows. And I think it's interesting. But he also retains this autonomy to where he can work. He's a bit of a paladin and he can work on operations that he feels, passionate about. And this Syrian civil war, he saw like what he thought initially a relatively easy way to help out by kidnapping this woman in Paris, which ultimately leads him into the heart of danger.
And he's not exactly impressed with the professionalism of the Free Syrian Army.
No, he's, as we talked earlier, the Free Syrian Exile Union, which is the name I gave to this expatriate group, they don't know what they're doing. Like they meet him the first time and they give them the address to their safe house and they don't understand the terminology he's using for the trade craft he wants them to adopt. The head of the organization is met with him in this Paris cemetery alone and brought in some guys with guns with him. But when the Gray Man told him to, lose the goons, he did it. He's like, I'm trying to help you guys here, but you're not doing anything to keep yourselves alive for the next 48 hours. And you're about to expand from going into this sort of aid organization into being an intelligence organization, which is what they would be like, intelligence operations to go in and kidnap this woman or whatever. And the Gray Man is like, he's rode hard and he's put up wet. He's like, I've been doing this a long time and you are not going to make it very long like this.
Well, it's hard to scale up an organization when you have no experience in it.
Yeah, exactly. And I wanted to show that. And I wanted to show that people were, the Syrians were doing the best with what they could and their hearts were in the right place. But they're sort of being used by different other forces out there.
Shakira Azam has her own interest in Bianca Medina, and she's using her personal security head, Sebastian Drexler, to help her put her influence into the world.
Yes. I wanted the first lady to be this really powerful person with her own agenda, which is different from her husband's. And she has...
Because things aren't fragmented enough. You have to have the royal family be fragmented as well.
I couldn't take the really complicated real world and leave it alone. I had to make it even more complicated. But no, the president and the first lady have kind of a difficult relationship. And this guy, Sebastian Drexler, who is a Swiss intelligence officer working for the Syrian government, has been sort of co-opted, pressured, cajoled by the Syrian first lady, who's really good at that, Shakira, to go to Paris and to try and kill Bianca Medina.
Now, Drexler is pretty much a black hat analog of Court Gentry, it seems.
Yeah, it's a yin and yang situation. I created him as a guy that started out kind of in the security industry. Started out as an intelligence officer, then worked for third world nations in Africa as kind of a fixer, and then it got bigger and bigger. And now he works for a Swiss bank. and the Azams have a lot of money hidden in these Swiss banks. And so the bankers sent Drexler down as the Mr. Fix-It, the European that can...
Mr. Wolf.
Yeah, Mr. Wolf, right, that can help keep the Azams in power and keep the money making its way up to the Swiss bank.
So have you heard of real Swiss banks having people like Mr. Wolf in their own?
No, not to that degree, no. I mean, it grew and grew. You know, I was trying to figure out what his tie-in to the Syrians was, and banking was... interesting, the fact that a lot of the money is in the first lady's name and all this stuff was interesting to me. And I just created him out of that. So if there is these Privat banks in Switzerland, which obviously there are, but if, you know, if they do have like Mr. Fix-Its that can go and do these sorts of things, I created a backstory for him where he's like, you know, poisoning guys that want to give their money to charity because the family hired him and, you know, all those sorts of different things. He's just a bad dude.
At one point, Court has to join up with some mercenaries. And you call them mercenaries. You don't call them private contractors or anything like that. It seems like you don't have too high of opinion of these mercenaries.
Yeah, there are private contractors that I do have very high opinions of. This group in this book is actually run by a German businessman that has these contractors. But I base this group on a company called Wagner, which is a Russian private security agency. They're supposedly independent from the Russian government, but that's baloney. They're totally members of the Russian government, or they're, you know, like working at the behest of them. They're called Wagner because the Russian special forces guy who started the company was a big Hitler file, and Richard Wagner was Hitler's favorite composer, so he named his company after them. That gives you a little insight into what kind of an organization they were. Back in 2014, they were in Ukraine. And when they would die, you know, people started saying, well, this Russian, you know, was buried in St. Petersburg and he died in Ukraine. And the government had to sort of admit that there were these ex-Russian special forces guys.
Were they the little green men? Or?
Yeah, they were part of the little green. Wagner specifically was not little green men, but it was going on at the same time. Little green men, I think, are real Spetsnaz, real special forces. But it was funny because the Russian government came back and said, well, these were Russians that died in Ukraine, but they were just must have just been there on vacation, which I just thought was hilarious, the doublespeak. So, yeah, so Court has got to infiltrate this group. They're not Russian in the novel. They come from all over the world. And he infiltrates this group of mercenaries just to get into Damascus, have some sort of cover story to get into Damascus.
Now, since the book really starts off in France, we have a couple of French actors on either side of the ball as well. And working for Drexler and Shakira Azam is a captain named Henri Sauvage.
Yeah, he is a French police officer, and he is crooked. He's a crooked cop for sure. I want the reader to have a little sympathy for him in certain parts of the novel. I don't like just pure black hats and pure white hats, but he's definitely gotten him into a situation that's pretty awful, and, you know, it's his fault that he's there.
Well, he shouldn't have had that last name.
Sauvage, yeah. Yeah, I had to come up with a lot of French names, and some of them work better than others, but I thought that worked well for him. Yeah, he was a character that, to me, I thought the Syrians would be using some sort of like proxy force in Paris. It helps the story when you have an action story that you've got more bad guys around than just a couple. And so, yeah, Henri Sauvage and a group of three other police detectives, they're working for Sebastian Drexler, who's actually working for the First Lady. They just assume they're working for the Syrian government.
And you have so many people in opposition to each other, and they have so much leverage over other people. It makes for a wide range of dynamics going on amongst the groups.
Yeah, I like tension in novels. I hate it in the real world, but I love it in my novels. And I like turning the screws on certain situations. So every relationship in this story, even if it's someone that the hero Court is working with, can't completely trust other people's motivations. He does trust the Halabis. They are sort of the white light in this whole thing. But again, as I said before, they're weak heads of this organization. But then, yeah, there's a French intelligence officer who's feeding information.
Vincent Volan,
yeah. He's feeding information to the Syrians, and he's quote-unquote helping the gray man. But Court has been through this, you know, many times before, and he knows not to trust this guy as far as he can throw him. He's able to get some good things from him, and then, you know, there's just always, in a gray man novel, there's always a double cross around the corner if you're not looking for it.
So often in the history of the books, people that help Court end up dead. So it's nice to see someone kind of looking out for themselves in this entire process.
Yeah, I'm growing him as a character to where he is stronger and not walking into dangerous areas with his eyes closed. and some of the other characters who, yeah, you're right, that would have ended up dead in an earlier book now have their own agendas and are keeping themselves.
I don't think CYA is necessarily a bad thing if you don't have the skills that Court Gentry has.
Yeah, exactly, right.
We talked about the Russians just a minute ago with current intelligence agencies and security agencies in America talking about Russia's attempt to at least mess around with the elections in 2016, and they're indicating that they want to do so in 2018. What do you think America should be doing in order to kind of downplay that Russian effect? And not even assuming they're trying to help one side or the other, just to sow discord perhaps, but
yeah,
you know, how do we stop them?
First and foremost, anybody that thinks it's not happening or is trying to minimize it or whatever, I mean, in my opinion, is a fool, because if you've read anything, you know that Russia tried this in France, and they did this in Estonia, and they did this in the Georgian invasion. And
Brexit, too.
Brexit, yeah, exactly. You know, they did it in the 2016 election, and it's not a right versus left question. It's just a simple thing that it's going on, and the Russians have done it. We need more anti-cyber resources in the government. I don't know enough about it to know, like, you know, in private sector, what can be done about it. But I do know that, like, you know, step one is saying this is happening. We've got to fight against this. It's just simple Russian playbook stuff. It's just this doublespeak and this sowing discord, creating confusion, just false stories, just everything like that they can do to make the situation crazy. And it worked so well after 2016. You know, the country is as fractured as I've ever known it to be. And Russia is certainly not responsible for all of that. But I'm sure they're clinking glasses at the Lubyanka, the office where the Russian spies are.
Now, the current administration says that the Russians have learned their lesson well enough that they don't need to impose any sanctions further. How do you view that?
I think it's ridiculous. I think the Russians have learned their lesson, that they were pretty successful about this, and they'll continue to do it again, and they'll get better at it, and hopefully we get better at defending against it. But I do think there should have been more sanctions. I think there should have been more sanctions with the Magnitsky Act. I really do see them as one of our biggest geopolitical threats.
Now, when we spoke last time, you said you were writing a book with a friend and you'd taken a research trip to France and Poland and Germany. What's the status of that project?
That book is called Red Metal, and it will be out May 19th of 2019, so a whole other year away. But I've been working on it all year amidst other things. And we're right at the phase. It's so funny. When you do a book tour like this, I don't know, before I was a published author, I always thought that this is when you take your victory lap for all the hard work you did the year before. Unfortunately for me, it's like I'm on the book tour and all I'm doing is thinking about, oh my God, I got to get this book in on time. So there's no victory lap. There's this, you know, this crunch for the next book. So this is the book we're wrapping up now. And it's a big novel, Russia versus NATO. We traveled to several countries. We went to Nellis Air Force Base. I've been up to D.C. a couple times to do research on it. It'll be out next year.
Now that you've handed off Jack Ryan to another writer, how does it feel to only have one main character running around your head most times?
Well, I mean, since I still wrote two books this year, I wrote a Gray Man book and Red Metal, so I'm not yet basking in that. I miss the Jack Ryan franchise in a lot of ways, but I think it was time for me to get off of that fast-moving train. I did 7 books in 6 years, so it was the right thing to step away. But I still find myself saying yes when people ask me to write books. So I wrote 2 books this year as well.
So where do the Gray Man's movie rights stand? It always seems to ever-shifting thing going on in Hollywood with his rights.
It has been ever-shifting. There was New Regency Studios had it for a few years, and then Sony Pictures got it 3 years ago. Their option was going to expire in the middle of July. I was going to get the rights back and pursue other opportunities, but they, in their contract, they were able to pay the full purchase price for the production price to me for the story, so they own it now. And so there's a director, I don't think I can say who he is, but it's a name that anybody would know. I had a conference call with him and his director of development a couple times. They're working on that. I think he's sort of circling it. It's not, you know, a sealed deal or anything like that. But Sony owns the rights. They are
outright. It won't ever revert back to you.
It won't revert back to me unless they want to sell it back to me or something. Hopefully they'll green light it and make it happen. There's some motivation on their side because they did pay the full production price to get that script. So hopefully they'll do something with it.
So in terms of books, what's up next for Court?
The next book is called Mission Critical, and due to my publisher this summer, and I've already started it, definitely outlined, plotted the whole thing. I'm going to go do some research in Scotland and back to the UK. just a couple locations that are going to be there, Scotland and England. And that,
finally, court won't stand out.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you spend a lot of words having court blend in when he's in the Sudan or something like that. There's ways that you would have somebody that looks like him there, and you have to build those up. Same for this book in Syria, where he's with this group of foreign mercenaries from all over the world.
Well, Mark, thanks so much for stopping back by and sharing court with us.
Thanks for having me again. Enjoyed it.
Mark Green is the author of Agent in Place, which is the seventh book in the Gray Man series, which is published by Berkeley Books. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.